On the line with us, we've got Robert Radler, who is the director of SS United States Lady in Waiting. It's a documentary I got a chance to take a look at today and was very impressed with it. Robert, great to have you on.
Oh, thank you very much, Andy. Glad to be here.
Tell us about this process of putting together a documentary on the SS United States. I'm sure a lot of people out there will go, the what? When did you get involved in this?
Well, start by saying the SS United States was the one great ocean liner ever built in the United States of America. Since 1958, no new passenger ships have been built in America. So the United States was really the epitome of American passenger ships and probably of all passenger ships. It was the fastest, safest ship in the world. It still is. And unfortunately, it's been rusting away in Philadelphia for about 36 years, actually. It sailed from 1952 to 1969. They retired in 69 because of the costs to run it. It had got very bad gas mileage.
Yeah.
and has been sitting ever since, which is a total shame because this is an engineering marvel on the scale of the Empire State Building, but completely forgotten. And part of what we're trying to do with this film, Lady in Waiting, is to bring its fate to the attention of the American people in hopes that the ship can be saved and hopefully restored to service.
Now, how did you find out about it? Is this something that you had been following, or did somebody come to you and say, hey, I have an idea for a documentary?
No. This is a lifelong, I guess you could say, obsession of mine. I thought I was obsessive, but then I met some other liner loonies, like my partner Mark Perry, who helped make this film a reality. Let's see. My dad took me to New York City. We lived in Brooklyn, New York, and he took me there when I was about 6 years old. And I saw ocean liner row, which was an amazing thing for a little guy. And I saw the Queen Mary, and I saw the Ile-de-France, and I believe the America. But the ship that really captivated my imagination was the SS United States. It looked like it was going 60 miles an hour, just standing still. And I think it probably raised kind of a budding sense of patriotism in me. It had the name of our country on it. It had this needle or razor-sharp bow, and it just looked amazing to a six-year-old boy. And I never forgot that. Years later, when I returned to New York to go to graduate school at NYU in filmmaking, I went to the docks in 1975 to look for the ship. And it wasn't there. No. And the reason why, it had been laid up some years before. And it took me 6 or 8 months to find the ship, which was kind of hidden behind a coal dock in Norfolk, Virginia, and to get permission to film on the ship, which I finally did in the summer of 1975. So you might say that this film actually began principal photography in the summer of 1975.
Now, were you able to incorporate any of that into the new project?
Yes. I shot two different things in 75. One was 16-millimeter film, which unfortunately has been lost. I believe my mom on a cleaning jag had something to do with that. She's compulsive about cleaning and the film disappeared. However, the good news is the slides I shot that day of the interiors of the ship before the ship was gutted are in the film and are a big part of the film.
The ship, the ocean liner, SS United States, was sealed, so a lot of the stuff was in great condition when you were there in 75.
Yes. In 75, the exterior of the ship was beginning to suffer. There was a lot of orange primer paint, and it no longer said United States. It just said States, I think.
Yeah.
But the interior of the ship had been dehumidified. They had sealed it, and it was in spectacular condition. The 50s period artwork and furnishings were all there. Elizabeth Taylor's cigarette still had her lipstick on them in the duck suite, which is the suite she took on the final version of the final journey of the ship, I believe, in 69. And everything was just left as it was. So it was, you know, almost a time capsule to walk through that ship and to see what it looked like. Unfortunately, in 75, the furnishings were not classic yet. There was an auction in the 80s where all the furnishings of that ship were sold And it was the biggest auction ever held in the history of the world.
I understand from watching the documentary, which I saw today, that this is like one of the top auction memorabilia for ocean liner people, people that love this stuff.
Yes. My partner, Mark Perry, has a home that has been written up nationally. He has many accoutrements from the ship. In fact, I believe he can seat 12 people at his dinner table, and everything on that dinner table is from the ship. The linen, the napkins, the salt shakers, the lamps, the forks and knives, the plates, everything from the ship. And he has a Normandy bedroom with everything from the Normandy.
Wow.
An SS United States bedroom where everything is from that ship. And this is pretty significant because a vase, a flower vase, or a wine cooling device is now worth between $5,000 and $10,000, and it may be more than that by now. You know, there are no great ocean liners left. I mean, the classic ocean liners are pretty much all gone. Queen Elizabeth II is going to become a static attraction in Dubai. She's making her last journey now. And what people don't understand is there's a vast difference between ocean liners and cruise ships. Ocean liners were on a schedule. They had to be in England at, you know, at a certain time, and they would take anything the North Atlantic could throw at them and keep the schedule, whereas modern-day cruise ships are much more fragile and kind of run away from storms. You know, they don't have to be somewhere at a certain hour. They're just cruising. By way of explanation, the United States could make it to Europe in about 3.5 days, and it takes the brand-new Queen Mary II 6 days to make the same trip.
I understand that the documentary was put together using Final Cut. I actually was on Apple's website, and I saw the story about it, which made me pretty happy. Tell us about the process in getting all of this, and is this Final Cut something you've used a lot?
Yes. I mean, Final Cut is something I use typically for some of my smaller projects, but there's no reason for that. I mean, I'm a mainstream television and film director, and on those projects, on big films or TV shows, I don't do the editing myself. It's done for me. I supervise. I don't put the crews together. I kind of show up and direct.
Yeah.
But the Final Cut enables you to get much closer to the filmmaking process. Actually, after doing all these mainstream things, it's a little bit scary to grab your own camera and to do your own cutting again. And Final Cut made it kind of easy. And in particular, there was one thing that really made it easy. I had footage, raw footage, from many sources, in every conceivable format and in every conceivable frame rate. When working in Final Cut 5, which is what I was in when I started this project, all of that footage had to be placed in the same format to make it editable without constant rendering, which would be enough to drive the editor crazy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was taking my HD footage and bringing it down to standard def and to 30 frames a second, and everything had to match to go into the timeline so I could edit it. This is incredibly expensive, incredibly time-consuming when you have 60 hours of footage in many formats. So when Final Cut 6 came along, the big benefit of number 6, version 6, was that it enabled you to take footage in any format at any frame rate and simply drag it into the timeline. It was almost magical. So my post-production guru, a fellow named Keith Roush at Roush Media in Burbank, suggested I upgrade to Final Cut 6 in the middle of the project.
Ooh.
This is a very scary thing to do. If something goes wrong, you could have lost months of work. But he was such a fan of this, and it was so good specifically for this film with all these formats, that I kind of held my nose and jumped and upgraded to Final Cut 6. And it worked like a charm. There was not one glitch. And since then, this enabled us, by the way, to show our rough cut to PBS, or American Public Television more specifically, in high def as opposed to in standard def, which has a great psychological advantage. And so the jump to Final Cut 6 was perfect, no problems, and it went so well that in my stupidity, I also decided to upgrade my system from the Tiger operating system to Leopard.
Ooh.
And there was absolutely no reason for me to do this other than I wanted to have Leopard. pretty dumb, but that also went off without a glitch. So I'm pretty happy that all worked. Big time. In terms of Final Cut Studio, the latest versions, we used Final Cut's color program to correct the color on both our new footage and the archival footage. And I was very, very concerned about the archival stuff because some of it was just downright ugly, dirty, faded, ugly. And color, in the hands of Keith Roush, who was an expert colorist, did an amazing job without, you know, digital fixes. I mean, without specific programs to restore the footage. Just the color program, which is part of Final Cut Studio, enabled us to bring back the color in the old footage, to clean it up, to make it vivid again. And we're so, so happy with the results. We frankly can't believe how good some of the old stuff looks.
Tell us a little bit about what you shot with as far as camera.
I have re-fallen in love with what I do for a living. You know, I've always shot film. I always shied away from video. But the latest generation of high-definition cameras, in particular, what we're using is the Panasonic HVX200, which is a camera that shoots high-def onto a P2 card.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, basically a memory card that fits right into your Mac, specifically into my old PowerBook G4. There's, the ExpressBuzz doesn't work on the newer MacBooks. You need an adapter, which I also have. But I use my old PowerBook just for this. Basically, on the set, you shoot onto these cards, you load them into your laptop, and dump them down onto an external FireWire drive, and you've got your footage. The scary thing is that then that card is erased and goes right back into the camera. So basically you're destroying your negative.
Ooh.
So we do all kinds of multiple backups and backups onto DVD in case there's any kind of problem with any of the drives. And thank God we do it because we have had a few issues from time to time.
The quality of that camera, though, was phenomenal. It really looked good.
It really is. And you know, it's very film-like. The HVX200 shoots in a format, I don't know if this is too technical, but this is a tech show, called 720pn, and the PN is progressive native. And what that means is most cameras that shoot at the more film-like 24 frames a second are actually shooting at 30 or 60 frames a second and doing an electronic pull-down. But this Panasonic actually shoots 24 discrete frames exactly like a film camera and with a very film-like shutter speed, so that what we're getting looks a great deal like 35-millimeter film. And the good news is, because we're just shooting data, I can shoot as much as I want. The more I shoot, it doesn't cost a whole lot more in terms of processing, printing, and all the other fees. The only thing I have to keep doing is buying hard drives. I don't even know how many I own. It's bizarre at this point.
I understand. Trust me. It was great to see that comment in the section in on the Apple website about that. And it's great to give more exposure for the film as well. Tell us about the process of putting the score together, too.
The score came from two sources. One was existing material, and the existing tunes mostly came from the Meyer Davis Orchestra, which played aboard the SS United States. There were three Meyer Davis Orchestras on the ship. And we were able to license that material, though it wasn't easy because the record company had gone defunct many, many years ago, and use the actual music that played on the ship in the 50s and 60s. So that was wonderful. The other thing that was even more wonderful was Steve Edwards, our musician. And Steve is a guy I've worked with before on my features and TV shows. Steve really had a feel for the ship and a feel for things nautical and put together the kind of score that brings tears to all of our eyes when they see the footage and hear his music. It just is so evocative and so emotional. He really put the crowning touch on the film with his music. And by the way, he was completely Macintosh-based as well.
How's the response been so far to certain people that have seen it? I mean, I know the grand premiere is coming up May 3rd on the Queen Mary.
Yes. Our Los Angeles, our West Coast premiere is May 3rd on the Queen Mary in what was once the boiler room, I believe, or the engine room. There is a New York premiere scheduled for the end of May. The show begins to hit the airwaves in the beginning of May with a high-def premiere in most markets around Memorial Day or the 4th of July. I don't know the scheduling of the show because it's different in each market. But if you're in a market where, you know, you can check with PBS.com or .org, I believe, and get the specific screening times for your market. And if it's not playing in the market where you're at, please call your PBS affiliate and request it.
I also notice you can even purchase a DVD. There's a website that's set up for this.
Yes. At the end of the show on PBS, you will see a link, an online link to be able to purchase the DVD. The name of our website is BigShipFilms.com. And the DVD will become available in early May, hopefully concurrent with the premiere.
Well, what do you think about the future of the SS United States? You're going to be showing this to, I'm sure, a wide group of people that will suddenly become even more interested now and maybe push for this ship to one day sail again?
Well, you know, the only bright note for this ship since it was laid up in 1969 has been its purchase by Norwegian Cruise Line about 4 years ago. Norwegian said that they would return the ship to service, and thus far they haven't done that, although they're taking very good care of it. The ship doesn't look good on the surface, but underneath, it's still very, very solid, much more solid than most new ships. It's got 4-inch thick, high tensile steel in its hull. That kind of steel, that quality of steel, that thickness of steel is no longer even manufactured. So there's, you know, this would be the strongest passenger ship on the seas, even at the age of 55. So we're hoping that this film encourages, and the response to it, encourages NCL to actually do what they said they would do and restore, refit the ship as a modern cruise ship. And we're just hoping that enough people become aware of this great American icon and want to see it preserved. People don't realize that there's a vast difference between an ocean liner, which the United States is, and a cruise ship, which is what everything else is. Cruise ships, well, ocean liners are on a schedule. They had to, this ship had to be in England in 4 days, and it got there every time, no matter what the North Atlantic would throw at it. It never slowed down. Whereas a cruise ship, confronted with a storm, goes and hides. It goes to the nearest port, waits out the storm, and then continues on its slothful way. The United States could go faster in reverse than any ship in existence can go forward. Any passenger ship, I should say, can go forward. So this was just an amazing hot rod, and it's the last of its kind. So it's in all of our interest to preserve the ship.
It's probably the biggest star you've worked with to date.
Yeah, that ship is even bigger than Wayne Newton.
Phenomenal. What next for you?
Oh, I am doing another film concurrently called Turn It Up. Turn It Up is the story of the electric guitar. And another passion of mine, another labor of love, just like Lady in Waiting. I'm a guy who played the guitar as a young man, put it away for many years, and when my son picked it up, I picked up the guitar again and fell in love all over again. Played for my dad, and he said, you know what, you need to do a film about the electric guitar. Wow. And that's exactly what we're doing. And the guitar film already has Slash, Les Paul, B.B. King, Paul Stanley, A Kiss, Robbie Krieger, The Doors, and many, many, many others. And that's going to be a spectacular film when it's finally finished.
And you're working with Jeff Baxter on this, right?
Jeff Baxter is my executive producer on Turn It Up. And we also used him as the finale of Lady in Waiting. He plays America the Beautiful on a digital guitar that sounds like a full orchestra in front of the ship as the ship goes from day into night behind him. And it's kind of very evocative. And, you know, when people first saw the finished Lady in Waiting, the lights came on and everybody in the room was crying. And I thought, oh, my God, it's not that bad. As it turns out, they were moved and... That's what we're hoping for. Just also signed on to do a horror film called Offering.
Ooh.
And I'm also prepping a film about wrestling, believe it or not. It's kind of a real-life story of a young man who kind of failed as, in a big way, in a national championship to win as a collegian and then went on to become a pro wrestler. And contrasting the world of collegiate wrestling with professional wrestling these days is what interests me about that one.
Ooh, that will be interesting. We'll have to look forward to that. Now, if our listeners want to keep a track on what Robert Radler's doing, what's the website that they could do this with?
Well, there are a number of them. My main website is robertradler.net. RobertRadler.com will also direct you to that site.
Cool.
The website for the SS United States film that I highly recommend you take a look at is called BigShipFilms.com. And if you're interested in guitars, try loudandlouder.com. That's loud, A-N-D, louder.com.
Phenomenal project. You really did it justice as somebody that came over to the United States on the SS United States.
Well, thank you very, very much, Andy.